Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to this evening's Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley program brought to you from the Lucy Stern Theater in Palo Alto. I'm John Boland, president of KQED. Tonight I'm delighted to introduce one of the giants of American journalism and public broadcasting in particular, Jim Lehrer, until recently executive editor and anchor of the PBS NewsHour and now author of Tension City, Inside the Presidential Debates from Kennedy-Nixon to Obama-McCain. Jim served 3 years with the United States Marine Corps before starting his journalism career in Dallas and later Washington, D.C., where he joined PBS. In 1973, he teamed up with Robert McNeil to provide live coverage of the Senate Watergate hearings, and 2 years later, they created the McNeil-Lehrer Report. Expanded to an hour-long format in 1983, the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour became the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer when Robin McNeil retired from the program, and in 2009 became the PBS NewsHour. The program continues on television on weekday evenings and online 24/7, and it is the flagship of public television's news and public affairs service. Before returning to KQED 18 months ago, I served for 4 years as chief content officer at PBS headquarters in Washington, D.C. And in that role, I had the opportunity and the honor to work with Jim as he revolutionized the NewsHour, merging the on-air and online news operations, developing the co-anchor system, bringing in Hari Srinivasan from CBS, and generally transforming the NewsHour into a 21st century operation. Jim oversaw tremendous changes, not the least of which was his calm and graceful transition out of the anchor seat earlier this year. But one thing about the NewsHour has not changed in more than 35 years on the air: the program's unmatched commitment to fairness, accuracy, and objectivity. As a journalist myself, I can tell you that Jim Lehrer sets the gold standard when it comes to integrity in media. His quest for excellence has brought him more than 30 journalistic awards, including 2 Emmys, the George Foster Peabody Award, the National Humanities Medal, and induction into the Television Hall of Fame. Although he no longer serves as the program's anchor, Jim continues to moderate Friday news analysis segments and produce specials, including the Emmy-nominated Debating Our Destiny, 40 Years of Presidential Debates. Nicknamed the Dean of Moderators, Jim has presided over 11 presidential and vice presidential debates. In an overheated political climate, Jim is often the one and only journalist that both sides can accept. They know he's going to ask the tough questions, but they also know he'll be fair and respectful. For Jim, journalism is a public service, not a game of gotcha. Somehow, he's also found the time in his schedule to become a best-selling author, credited with 20 novels, 2 memoirs, and 3 plays. Our moderator this evening is David Kennedy, the Donald J. McLaughlin Professor of History Emeritus at Stanford University, co-director of the Bill Lane Center for the American West, and Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Freedom from Fear, The American People in Depression and War. Please join me in welcoming Jim Lehrer and David Kennedy.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Well, Jim, let me welcome you to Palo Alto and to California and to this occasion.
Thank you, David.
This is a bit of a turnabout situation for you, and I hope we can live up to the maxim of turnabout being fair play. Since you've written the book about how you've asked the questions over
many years. Yes.
So I'm here tonight to play Jim Lehrer to your Jim Lehrer. I'm going to ask you the questions.
Okay.
And you're expected to give the
What kind of answers?
Okay. Accurate, concise.
Accurate, concise. Okay.
So I'm going to begin with a sentence from your book where you say, quote, "Nobody cares what the person asking the questions thinks about anything." But I hope you'll allow an exception for that tonight, because I hope it will interest you to know that I think this is a really interesting book.
Keep talking. That's good. That's good. That's good, David.
So I think we're going to have a rich discussion about it and its subject matter. So as you say, and as the historical record shows us, there have been 35 presidential or vice presidential debates since the original debate between Richard Nixon and John F. Kennedy in 1960, 16-year hiatus till 1976. But now, as you use the phrase, we now have a debate imperative, that it has become part of our political culture and expectation that there will be these kinds of events. And the debate imperative, as you say, is firmly established. And as we're seeing, even virtually as we speak this week, that imperative has extended now to the primaries. Well over a year in advance of the actual general election, we're seeing a round of, in this case, Republican presidential primaries or primary debates. So this has become part of our culture, and I dare say you're part of the process that made it so deeply embedded this in our culture. So let's begin at the beginning with your title. Why did you title this book Tension City?
Well, first of all, thank you very much, David, and thank you all for coming. I always am surprised when people come out at night to hear me speak. I'm used to seeing people on television environments. Look, Tension City, the title comes from this. The backstory is this. I worked on this book, and you understand this, David. Anybody who's written a book understands. You start with a working title. And in this case, I started this book maybe 2.5-3 years ago. And the title from day one was Moderator. And every note I took, everything I read, every transcript I went over, everything, new thing I wrote it with that in mind, that this book was called Moderator. And the book is done, finally, and it's all ready with a ribbon around it, and it's ready to go to lead, in other words, to be set in print. And my editor at Random House, a wonderful man named Bob Loomis, calls me from New York, and he says, Jim, we have been talking. That's when you want to go back a little bit. And we're not sure that Moderator is a really terrific title for this book. And I said, I was very defensive. I said, well, that's just too bad, because that is the title. And then he asked me, David, you'll understand this. He then said, well, Jim, would you buy a book with a title called Moderator? Oh, God. I said, well, let me think about it. Let me think about it. And I had, in addition to the experience I've had, as David mentioned, moderating these 11 debates, I also had the additional privilege. I really considered a privilege and an honor and all that, all those other kinds of words, to interview just about all of the candidates for president and vice president who participated in one of these debates, and to talk to them exclusively about their debate experience. Well, one of the interviews I had was with former President George H.W. Bush. He told me a lot of wonderful things, by the way. He hated those debates. Only one who did that, but we'll get to that in a minute maybe. But in the course of that conversation I had with him about the debate, it was about 8 years after he had left the White House, and I was having an interview with him, you know, with two cameras for a television documentary, and I asked him some hard-hitting, you know, penetrating question like, well, what were they like, Mr. President? And he said, oh, Jim, he said, those high-profile things, they were Tension City. Well, when Loomis asked me that question, you know, think of another title, I remembered what George H.W. Bush had said. So I immediately called Random House back and said, how about Tension City? And they said, yes! But the reality of the title and why President Bush said that is really applies to what these things are all about. In my experience, and everybody has different experiences, and I'm sure people who played high level athletics or played high level this or been in any kind of high visibility operation where you were subject to all kinds of observation. I think I put that fairly well, don't you?
So
yeah,
far, so
okay,
good.
Okay. It goes, tension goes with it.
Sure.
For everybody connected. And with these debates, everybody involved, everybody from the person who opens the door to let the people in, to the candidates, to the moderator, to the handlers, to the this and the what, the technicians, the people who turn the cameras on, or the people who turn the sound on and it doesn't work, or the people who are supposed to make the teleprompter work and it doesn't work. Everybody involved in these things, it's tension city for them.
Well, and you do a wonderful job not only of describing the kind of tension that the candidates themselves must feel, but that you feel yourself person responsible for conducting the debate. Let me read a brief passage here.
Sure.
Again, I think goes to what you're pointing toward, the truly serious elements of tension that are just naturally inhabit this kind of a situation. You say the incredibly high stakes are what magnify it all in presidential debates. Candidates and their attendants have only one overriding purpose, to win the election, to be the most powerful person in the world. But others, including most in the serious press and political science worlds, see debates as decisive opportunities to inform and educate the voters about whom to grant such power. The critical space between those two very different purposes is the battleground on which all combat occurs. Now, you clearly could not use that passage as a title.
No, that wouldn't work.
but I do think it captures the essence of the story that you tell repeatedly.
And that is exactly how I feel about it. I mean, that's what it's all about. And every time I would get upset or I'd be with somebody who was upset about some candidate handler who had stepped over the line or done something, this and that, or whatever, I always remind myself, hey, look, these people are dealing with an outcome that can affect who's going to be the leader of the free world. This isn't a debating exercise. This isn't even a television. In fact, I tell people all the time, this is not a television program. This is an integral step in the process that leads to the election of the President of the United States. And everybody involved in it needs to keep that in mind.
And yet there is this tension, or maybe even put it more strongly, this contradiction between this high-minded purpose that you and others represent of trying to make this an occasion to educate the electorate at large about what's happening, and this the raw desire of the candidates themselves to win on that, what you call that battleground.
Exactly.
So how effective a battleground is it? Is it really an absolutely indispensable part of the electoral process or
it's,
not?
It's become that. Absolutely, it's indispensable. It's indispensable for a couple of very obvious reasons, but obvious reasons have a need to be often repeated. It's the only time during an election campaign where the candidates are on the same stage at the same time talking about the same things. They always come in late fall, in other words, late September, early October, close to the election itself. According to the polls I have seen, and I've had this verified by a couple of other folks that know more about polls than I do, that by the time you get to these debates, more than 90%, roughly 90% of the voters have already either decided for whom they're going to vote or are leaning very strongly toward one candidate or another. So then what are the debates about? Well, the debates are not about lock boxes for Social Security or about getting in and out of Afghanistan. They're about taking the measure of the individual. They're about temperament. They're about, can I actually see that person sitting behind a desk in the Oval Office? How would that person react to another 9/11, to another Katrina? What if he or she were confronted with a decision about sending Americans into harm's way? See, you know this a lot better than I do. I mean, you're an educated man, not a journalist like I am, but presidencies are about the unexpected. They're not about the expected. The campaigns are about the expected. You talk about, if you elect me, I'll do this, and I'll do this, and I'll do this. Well, just look at the last two presidents. Barack Obama barely mentioned the financial situation or the economy during that campaign. It barely came up. But it was what his presidency has been about these last 3 years. George W. Bush didn't say a word about terrorism.
before he was elected in the year 2000, and then there came 9/11. And that's what his presidency became about. And it is, and that is always the case. So those debates are so important in a kind of way that are, you could almost, now I will do better from here on out. I promise you, David. My friend and colleague, former colleague Robert McNeil, used to say, Lara, if you were ever a guest on our program, we'd never have you back because your answers are so damn long, I promise you I will give you shorter answers than this, but on your other questions. But the point here is that it's the measure of the individual that the public has no other place to take it except there. And right then, some people decide at the last minute, but it basically is a confirming process for a lot of people. Oh, yeah. But it's also a turnoff for some people. I don't like that guy. I may agree with him, but I don't like him. And by then, here again, you know this better than I, people start in a presidential campaign. Right now, on the Republican side, they're all running from the right. And then by the time there's a Democratic candidate, by the time they finally get on the stage in September and October, there's very little daylight between them because they run toward the center and all the rough edges are gone and all that sort of stuff. So the issues of temperament and what you think of them as an individual become even more important, and that's the answer to my very long answer to your very brief question.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Without disputing at all that it is important for a voter, for the voters in general, to use your phrase, to take the measure of the man or the woman, as the case may be. The question still, I think, sits out there. Is this the best format, the best way to do that? And, in fact, the format of the debates, as you chronicle, has changed a lot.
Absolutely.
Over the years.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Is this the best way to do it? Are there other ways? And of the formats that you've witnessed and been part of, is one or other better than others or what?
Oh, David, it's very complicated. Here again, it goes back to that quote you read from me. The formats are decided by the candidates in conjunction, in negotiation with the debate commission. And the negotiation process is driven by advantage, seeking advantage. For instance, if you have a candidate who is quick and can give concise answers, you may want a particular kind of format. If you've got somebody that's all over the lot with answers, you may want a different kind of format for him or her. You got somebody who really knows how to feel somebody's pain, to coin a phrase, in a group setting with voters, you may want a town hall setting. And that's why there's a town hall setting, because Bill Clinton wanted it.
No.
And I mean that those things happen. It isn't because of some great political science guru in the sky decides how to do these things. And to answer your question specifically, the best format that I have dealt with, that I have observed and dealt with as a moderator, was the one that didn't work as well as it should have, because a lot of that was my fault, not all of it. But it was the first debate in 2008 between Barack Obama and John McCain, where the rules were: ask a question, you got a 2-minute answer, then you had a 1-minute response, then you had from 5 to 9 minutes at the discretion of the moderator to kind of flesh it out. And the idea was that the candidates could address questions to each other, they could talk to each other and whatever. And I thought, my God, this is dynamite. There was only one problem. As the whole world saw, and I made a fool of myself trying to fix it, was John McCain did not want to do that. He wouldn't even look at Barack Obama, as you remember. He would not address any questions to him. He just, I don't know whether he didn't get the word or he just didn't want to do it. I don't know.
You referred to him at one point as that one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was an interesting kind of thing, and it hurt him. It hurt him. Now, see, here's your point, though. Now I'm making your point for you, that you think, well, so what? You know, why should that be held against him? You know, because that he didn't look at Barack Obama, or he wouldn't call him Barack You know, and Obama keeps calling him John, and Obama keeps saying, and McCain keeps saying, Senator, you know, this and that, all the other thing. But it was held against him in the polls because it showed, according to the polls at least, people watched it. For some people, whatever, you know, they might have thought about other candidates before, that it was a negative thing about McCain because he showed he was fidgety and he wasn't comfortable in his skin and he was angry and he dissed Obama and all that. It was held against him, and he never recovered in the polls after that first debate. That's what the pundits say.
You're very hard on the so-called town hall format. At one point you say it changed everything, although it changed back again. Stuck just with that format. And at one point you compare the town hall format to a game show, which is a pretty severe criticism coming from the likes of you, I would say. So,
well, I don't remember saying anything like that.
Do you remember I ever said anything like that?
But the defense of the town hall format, I suppose, is that this is an opportunity for citizens in an unintermediated way to put their questions directly to the candidates and to get these elite media hobnob guys out of the picture. So how do you respond to that? What's the defense from your side?
My defense is that what happens is you get 140 people that are picked by the Gallup organization or the Wawa organization, and they're a cross-section of citizens. They cover the political landscape, the gender landscape, the racial landscape, the age landscape, and you have 140 people. I've done this, where you sit down and you say, okay, now, each of you, the subject here is domestic affairs, if that's what it is, and you write two questions. And I'd always give them some guidelines on, remember, the shorter the question, the better the more chance you're going to have of having a direct answer, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But not try to influence anybody's questions at all. But so you get 280 questions. Now, each one, the way the rules work and the way you, by the time you get through, you know that about 24 questions out of those 240 are going to be asked. What is 2 times 104? Yeah, that's right. I was right. So only 24 of them are going to be asked. So who chooses those 24? The moderator does. And it is not as spontaneous. The questions are real. They've been written by real people. But the experience I had the most hellish experience of my whole debate. Well, it's chronicled in that book. It was in St. Louis at a town hall meeting where I had these 240 questions, and time got out. I had to decide on the 24. Not the 24. I would pick more than that, but I knew I was only going to get to 24. First break was, the first cut was, what were the best questions? And in particular areas. And then the next cut was, then you go through them and you find out, you don't have a representative group of voters. You can't have 24 questions from left-handed white males. So you've got to go back through it, and you had to keep doing it. And staying on subject, keep trying to keep the spirit of the thing going. And the one thing that was not present at all was any spontaneity at all. Because the candidates, what they do, the ones who really have facility for this, what they do is they take a town hall question or a town hall answer and then kind of play with it. They don't answer it. They just play with it. I remember my favorite one, my favorite all-time town hall meeting. I picked the question. It was in St. Louis, and I picked the question. There was a young person, and it was toward the end of the debate, and I thought it was just a terrific opportunity for somebody to say something. And I said, I called on the person. I knew exactly what the question was that she was going to ask, and she stood up. She said it forcefully. She said, what do you have to say to the young people of America about what you would do as president? And George W. Bush leaned over and went right over to her, which you could do in those town hall meetings, and said, well, the real issue here is what we're going to do with Social Security. I rest my case.
Well,
and so, I then asked the follow-up. See?
Well, we have a version here at the Commonwealth Club of the town hall format. Members of the audience have sent questions up here to us. And here's one that I'm going to give you that doesn't directly address your experience moderating debates, but it grows out of your contact with the political system that works the way it works at that level. So are you ready for this? If there was
is it critical?
Hold on, I haven't got to.
Okay. All right.
If there was an entrance exam for presidential candidates that had one question, what would that one question be?
Well, first thing I would say to you is that's a really, whoever asked that question, you asked a really terrific question. It's the kind of question. No, that's. It reminds me of the time my little daddy said to me. I don't think I'm smart enough to answer that in a way that because if you had one question, it would largely depend on. Here again, it sounds like I'm dodging it. I'm not dodging it. It's just I'm not capable of answering it. I don't think intelligently, is because the context you if you were to say right now. If you were to date it, as of right now, this is October, what, the 19th, 18th? Okay, 2000, what, 11, right. And what would be the question you would ask right now? It would have to be something about, my answer, I'm just going to answer his question, that person's question, honestly. It has nothing to do with politics or anything. I think if you had one question to ask a candidate right now, in this year, right now, this moment, would be, what are you going to do about the growing disparity of wealth in the United States of America?
There's another question I really am dying to ask you about which of
is that fair? Is that can you do that under the rule?
That's an excellent question. But it's a question I'll ask it or I'll pose it, but I'm going to go on to an easier question.
All right.
But keep this one in the back of your mind, and that is of the people you've seen up close in these debates, winners and losers, which of them do you think struck you at the time as the most presidential? But I want to go on and give you some time to think about that. So let's ask a little
no
more.
No way in hell I'm going to answer that.
Well, here's a little more concrete version of the question. maybe cast a little different frame that you can answer. Which of the people that you've dealt with in the 11 debates that you've moderated, or if you care to expand the field of inquiry to all 35 that you've seen, which of them took best advantage of the occasion?
Oh, that's a great question. I think there are several examples. John Kerry, even though he didn't win, I thought John Kerry took, as a debater, and took advantage of particularly in the first debate with George W. Bush in 2004, the debate that I moderated in Coral Gables, Florida, because Iraq had already happened, and I thought that the word on Kerry was he wouldn't do that well because he couldn't talk concisely and all that, and I thought he took real advantage, and he changed the polling numbers dramatically with his performance in that debate. I think that more recently, George W. Bush, in the way he handled. Some of the kind of interesting ways that Al Gore decided to kind of attack George W. Bush. I thought George W. Bush handled himself very well in that, in a way that was very positive, in a way that helped him. No matter what anybody thinks the real outcome of that election was, in terms of those debates. But it's really, there's nothing really stands out. For instance, the first one, Nixon, which I was not there for, obviously, but Nixon and Kennedy, that probably decided the outcome of that election. But that had to do with it, primarily had nothing to do with substance. It had to do with the fact that Nixon had been sick, and he looked terrible, and he wouldn't allow Howard K. Smith, the moderator, said, "Hey, we got some makeup here, sir, Mr. Vice President. They'd be glad to have you make up, be made up." "No makeup, no makeup." And if somebody put some powder on him, and there was some sweat on his over his lip, and he looked terrible. He looked sick, which he was. And people who listened to that on the radio thought Nixon won that debate hands down. People who saw it on television thought Kennedy won hands down. And in that case, Kennedy used the debate, and somebody looking at it in a positive way, used all of that to his advantage. And the other thing they did, and somebody mentioned that Chris Matthews has written a book about Jack Kennedy. Well, one of the things he's talked about is in that first debate, Bobby Kennedy, who, as you remember, was the manager of Jack Kennedy's campaign, knew that, of course, that Nixon was a little bit feverish and intentionally had the heat turned up in the studio at WBB in Chicago.
Well, also, if I remember correctly, Jack Kennedy also psyched out Nixon when the question was asked, who wants makeup? Kennedy said, "I don't want any."
Oh, yeah.
So Nixon thought, "Well, I better not have any either." And
absolutely.
Then Kennedy actually went off and put some on.
But he
is that correct?
I don't know about that, but I do know that he looked that Kennedy looked tan, and the reason he looked tan is because he had Addison's disease, and the treatment caused his skin to tan.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's just. But what's interesting about the temperature thing is that ever since then, and I've been there for 11 of them. I mean, it's like going into a meat locker because they're ice cold because nobody wants to sweat because look what happened to Nixon, you know. It's the Nixon lesson about sweating. So, and they negotiate that. I mean, that's part of the negotiation.
The temperature.
At the stage, at the podium will be boom, boom degrees. Yeah. And they sign a little wah-wah for it.
Yeah. Yeah. So another question from our audience. What did you think of last night's Republican debate, which resulted in candidates directly criticizing and interrupting each other?
You know, I was traveling last night, and I didn't see that debate.
Well, how about your opinion about the Republican debates in general?
Well, I've seen all the other ones, and I will see the other ones when I get home, because I'll be there all, I'd see the one last night when I get home. I think they certainly performed the purpose, which is to weed out the candidates. They did, and there were 40 of these things in 2008, Democratic and Republican, because there was no incumbent. And in 2008, it was dramatic. Barack Obama was the worst debater on the stage. I mean, Chris Dodd, Joe Biden, Hillary Clinton, they were all better debaters than Obama. But each debate after that, Obama kept getting better and better and better. And by the time they went to their final debate, Obama was pretty good. And what's happened in the Republicans, and the most dramatic case that, of course, is Rick Perry. I mean, he just announces and suddenly he's the front runner. Then he's in a debate and he's no longer the front runner. And he goes in another debate and he's even less of a front runner. He goes in another debate, he's even less of a front runner. And that's solely the result of the people seeing him perform. And you could argue, here again, you could argue, and some people do, serious people argue, well, that's not fair, that's no, you know, these debates shouldn't, how somebody handles him or herself in that kind of situation shouldn't be a way to judge somebody who's president of the United States. I would argue the contrary.
Yeah. Of course, what we're talking about here, obliquely, I guess, is the power of television.
Absolutely.
As a medium, and the enormously powerful influence it has on the structure and character of these debates. That leads me to pose another question from the floor here from an audience member about the changes in your news program, which I think many people would agree is the most serious news program on the air and has been for a long, long time. But it, too, has changed over the years. So what has guided you? You've been the editorial director of that program for a long time. How has it changed and why?
Well, it hasn't changed on purpose. That's one of the great things about working there is that everybody who works here wakes up in the morning. They know who they are and what they're there to do. What's changed is the technology has changed. We are no longer just an appointment television program. We are a serious source of news, and as John said in the introduction, we're there 24/7. What we did, and it was brutal, we had an online operation, and we had our regular broadcast operation. And the online people didn't know that much about journalism, and the journalism people didn't know a damn thing about the technology. And so we said, look, for all kinds of reasons, primarily being this is the future and we want to be part of it, and primarily because we want to increase the reach of our kind of journalism and our serious journalism, we're going to put our two teams together, and that's where my Marine experience came in handy, because everybody, no, you can't do that, and the executive producer of the NewsHour, Linda Winslow, said, Jim, I think you're going to have to do it the Marine way. And so the Marine way is, as of 10 o'clock tomorrow morning, you are one. And it was hard. It was difficult. But it's worked. Yes, there was some blood on the table. But it was in-house blood. And we have not changed. We've changed this way. The only way we really have changed is that we do not, as I say, we don't see ourselves just as a television program anymore. And I really do not care if somebody watches us do you have a pink iPod with your name engraved on it, David?
No.
You don't? Okay. But if you did, and you watch the NewsHour on it, that wouldn't bother me at all. And if you watched it at midnight instead of 6 o'clock Eastern Time, and if you watched one segment and then went to another segment the next day, if you went to our website and let's say that part of the story, let's say it's a Jeff Brown story that involves an interview with Winston Marsalis, and Jeff actually interviewed him for 45 minutes, and you want to see the whole 45 minutes online, I think that's all just fabulous. And the cross-fertilization, and we worked very hard. We discovered one of the reasons that caused us to really think, hey, we've got to do something here. And we had some surveys and John Boland knows about this. He was very much involved in this because he said he was director of content at PBS at the time. We discovered in the NewsHour that 40% of the people who watched online NewsHour never watched the NewsHour broadcast. 40% of the people who watched the regular NewsHour broadcast did not go online. And we've realized that there is an audience there for both, in other words, there was a concern for serious news and a need and a desire for serious news on these two outlets, and so we had to we've been much more successful than I thought we would. I thought it was going to take a lot longer than it has, but we have brought these two audiences together and cross-fertilize them both. And we got a long way to go, but we're getting there.
How do you feel, given the serious commitment that you've made in a long, distinguished career to responsible journalism, how do you feel about what is now just ambient in our culture from coast to coast, is the demonizing of the media and the very low respect for the media in general?
Well, I think the important thing there, David, is people have to be very specific. I'm not a knee-jerk defender of the media. I mean, I think there are some elements of the media deserve to be criticized, and I would join the criticism. I think that the public should be more vigilant. You do not have to put up with certain kinds of journalism practices. And the way you stop them is by complaining. This is journalism is not run by committees of this and that of the Congress or whatever. It is out there for it's the democratic process. It's at the basis on which every decision that is made in this country, somewhere underneath there is a news story. Because people have to have informed opinions, not only to vote, but to do other things in this democratic society. And the only place they can get that information, the only way they can get informed, is to participate in the journalism process in some form. You may get it on the online slowly, you may get it on radio, you may get it on television, you may get it on any kinds of other ways. In print even. You know, print, remember the printed page and all that sort of stuff. And so this is serious business. That's what you're saying, and I agree. This is it. When we talk about doing things at the News Hour or somebody else, some of the news organizations doing so, we're fooling with the democratic process. This is serious business. And when somebody says to me, "Oh well, that newscast isn't really fun," I'm thinking, "Oh, isn't that too bad?"
Is it fair to say, given your description of the way the News Hour is now packaged and delivered, that you're indifferent if people pick up one segment or two segments 24 hours later, 48 hours later, that programs like yours, at least, and maybe many other as well, are no longer, their function is not as reportorial, as breaking news reporting as they once were, and your kind of program in particular has become more analytic and explanatory, so people don't need to see it in real time. It's just fine with you if they see it several days later. Is that a fair statement?
It's not only a fair statement. You're on to what I think is really a very important thing that's happening. And the News Hour, I tell our folks now that we are no longer just a first responder. We are second or third responder. You may hear on the radio or read on a blog that you say, "Oh, George W. Bush was really born in Kenya." And you hear that on the radio. Well, you're not sure that's true. Where do you go to find out exactly where he was born in a way that makes sense? And then you want to go, "By the way, what happened to Kenya?" And you want to go someplace there, whatever. Or if there's a news story that breaks and you just hear a little bit about it and you heard the president say, well, the president said that he's going to veto every bill that's printed with a margin of under three inches on the left side of the page. And you say, well, where can I go to find out whether the president said that and when he said it? And I might want to hear him say it. I want to read it, but I may want to hear it and see. And that's where I think eventually, and there's already some stuff that we're doing ourselves in the News Hour, some collaborative things and some conversations about how we collaborate with other news organizations to create a place that can be trusted, that you can go to when you hear, because increasingly there's a storm, there's an absolute avalanche of information out there, more so, and that's a terrific thing. That's great. There's more stuff out there than there ever has been. But it requires, I hate the word, but it's a word that's being used. It requires some curating. I would say it requires some editing in the journalism world. But that's where we're going. And that's why you're exactly right about the News Hour. If somebody comes to watch our program, say at 6 o'clock Eastern Time, I would guess that 90% of our audience probably already has a general feeling for what happened today in the last 24 hours. What they come to us for is for more information about it, some insights on it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Just like, and these news, and news, American newspapers, that is where the future of American newspapers is. They just don't know it yet.
Yeah. Well, the New York Times, for example, I've noticed the last many months, maybe a couple of years now, features frequently on the front page an item that's called news analysis.
Right.
And it's a kind of a blend of opinion and reporting, but it's not straight reportorial news.
That's right.
And neither is it quite commentary. It's something in between. It's a new genre or subgenre, it seems to me, in
that's
the
right.
larger world of journalism.
I agree. And that's going to only grow. I think.
Now, there's another genre that's also emerged on television in recent years, most conspicuously represented by The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. And we have a question from the floor here. The simplest form of the question is, do you, Jim, watch The Daily Show? I think the broader question is, where do you put that in the spectrum of journalism, serious or frivolous or useful or not?
Well, the answer to the question is yes, I watch The Daily Show. I don't watch it every day, but I've even appeared on it about 3 weeks ago. I'll tell you an interesting story about this. See, I'm not dodging your question. I'm going to get to that. But I'm violating the rules here. I always tell people, the first thing to do, answer the damn question, and then maybe you do your explanation. But at any rate, there's several years ago, not too many years ago, there was a survey of some kind. You know, there's surveys about anything you want. It could have been 12 people on a street corner in McKinney, Texas. But anyhow, they were given a list of 25 television anchor people and told to rank them in terms of trust. There were the leaders, the most trusted of the news anchors. There was a tie for the lead between me and John Stewart. And some people said, my God, that's awful. Well, here's the thing about my attitude about John Stewart is that you just have to remember what John Stewart is. He's a comedian, and he uses the news to say funny things. Yes, he's a commentator. He's not a reporter. If somebody just got all their news from John Stewart, you would not be well informed. He's not in the well informed business. Some things he says might appear to be well informed, and he says it. You know, in fact, he said that to me. He said, "Don't you find it interesting that here I'm a guy who makes up the news, and here's a guy who reports the news, and people think we're both doing the same damn thing?" Yeah, John, I agree.
Well, going back to the presidential debates and the subject of your book, we have two questions here again from the audience that seem to point to the same general area. One is, how do you get the candidates to get away from their programmed responses? That's a skill I'm sure you've honed over the years. But a closely related question, in moderating all these presidential debates, which candidate or candidates over the years have been the most difficult and why?
Well, let's answer that first one first. If a candidate refuses to get off the prepared notes, there's no way in hell you're ever going to get it done. I mean, you make a fool of yourself trying. What you have to do is expose the fact that it's happened. And I do that all the time. And sometimes I go too far, sometimes I don't go far enough. You say, okay, Kennedy, what's your position on Social Security reform? Well, Jim, that's a really great question, and reminds me of the time my daddy had Social Security and all that. In other words, say no answer. I say, okay, yeah, but the question was, what's your position on Social Security reform, Dr. Kennedy? Well, my mother also had Social Security. You know? So then the issue is for the interviewer is, okay, do you ask the same question again? Or a lot of people would like for people like me to say, hey, you didn't answer the damn question. Or more in my case, this is I've been doing this for 36 years, and I know there are people who have been watching this program waiting one night for that time when I ask Sammy Billy Bob Dunn, Senator Billy Bob Dunn, a question. And the senator answers it, and I yell, liar! same kind of thing. But it's not going to happen, because I believe, in my case, I speak only for myself, my basic premise, I know this sounds pompous and goody two-shoes, but you're just going to have to think that about me. But I really do believe that the people who are watching our program are just as smart, or watching any presidential debate are just as smart as I am. And they'll pick this up. They'll realize you asked a question twice, you asked a question three times, the guy's not answered. I don't have to tell them that. Just move, you know, the issue is do you have to do it skillfully enough where the point is made and then move on. And the issue is when you move on, that's when you can make the mistake. That's where I've made the mistake many times, where I've moved on too early or moved on too late. But the point is made, and you don't have to, I don't think that's the interviewer's job to judge right there in front of it. Let some analyst or let some commentator come back and say, hey, Billy Bob didn't answer the questions. Not the person who asked them. That shouldn't be the job of the person who asked
them. We have a question or a comment from the floor that asks, in effect, about the capacity of technology to serve the liar function.
Yeah.
That you could, the screen, somebody could project on screen the factual accuracy of a statement the candidate had just made. And that's at least technologically possible. How would that work?
It would really work. That would really be interesting.
Have you ever discussed such a thing with the...
No, I haven't. No, because
you're not answering the question.
You're right. Well, that would just, I mean, you would have to, if on factual things, they do that. You know, fact checking.
Yeah.
We've done a lot of that and a lot of major newspapers do fact checking. But so much of what people say isn't a case of facts. It's a case of one's point of view, a view about the facts. And whether you agree with it or disagree with it, and somebody says, well, what that adds up to is socialism. All right, you can say, no, it doesn't. Well, it does in that person's view.
Yeah.
You know, so you got to be real careful with judging answers. That is a role for journalism, but not for the role of the straight news part of journalism. That's the role for the analytical and the opinion part of journalism.
Okay. This is a question, again, that takes us beyond the immediate situation of presidential debates, although it may have some implications for this, but I think I'd be derelict in my duty if I didn't give this question voice. And I'm sure many people will be interested in your answer to it. Will the Citizens United ruling remain the law of the land? And if so, what will be the long-term impact? And one might say, what will be the long-term impact on the practice of presidential debates, if any?
I don't know about whether it's going to remain a law of the land. It's up to the Supreme Court. I see no reason. There's no evidence to suggest that they're going to reverse that. So I would say, as of now, I mean, you'd have to have a death on the court and an appointment for that to happen, of a particular kind of justice, for there to be a reversal. And if it stays in effect the way it has, it's going to be continue to affect elections the way, I don't know if it's affecting the outcome, but it's certainly affecting the way they're run right now. There's just an awful lot of money out there. And unfortunately, it's money that is what that decision did. The most significant development to come from that decision was that it removed accountability and transparency from where the money comes from. There are some that argue, well, transparency, even if you knew, and the money would still be there, and it would still be bad, and all of that. But I think at least you would be out. I mean, democratic society is dependent on transparency. I mean, that's the whole point of the exercise, is knowing what's going on, and
just doing it.
That's right. And then if the majority of the people think that's bad, okay, fine. Then they can change things. That's how it works. But if you don't know about it, then there's not anything the American people or anybody else can do about it. So that's the step. That to me is the most, the most significant development there. And I think I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Now, you're very kind and generous in your book to two of the people who appear with you every Friday.
Yeah.
Brooks and Shields.
Right.
They're the latest incarnation of a segment that's been around for quite a long time. Can you say anything about the origins of how you came to, in the first place, have such a segment on the program? And if you care to, who besides Brooks and Shields have done it well?
The genesis of it was really David Gergen. We've done a lot of stuff with David over the years. David, as you know, has worked for five presidents, and he's done an awful lot of things. At that time, it was early on with the NewsHour, and he was interviewing some authors for us for the NewsHour. And I remember having a conversation with McNeil and some others. Well, we ought to do something else, you know, on a regular basis on politics. And So I'm the one who said, why don't we put somebody with David David's a conservative, but a moderate conservative, somebody that's who is comparable. And let's see if it see if we can make magic, see if it works. And using McNeil's rules are simple, or have always been very simple, which are there's only one kind of discourse we're going to have on this program, and it's civil discourse. So as long as you know that, and David Gergen is certainly a civil discourse man, and so we just found another one, and that was Mark Shields on the other side. And then David, when David went to work for Bill Clinton, that didn't work anymore. So Falgy Goh, who was in the Wall Street Journal, Washington Bureau, took David's place. And then when Paul became editor of the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal, then he was replaced by David Brooks.
Is there anything to be remarked in the fact that what we might call the left chair has been occupied by the same person through the whole cycle, but the right chair has been cycled through different people?
No.
That's just coincidence.
It's just life the way it's lived.
You mentioned earlier, you talked about it a little bit in the book, but I wonder if you could expand on it, about the role of the Commission on Presidential Debates.
Yeah.
It's not a publicly funded body, or is it? I really don't know much about it.
No, it's privately funded. It's funded by well-meaning, good-thinking American companies. So there's some corporate funding in there. It is not nonpartisan. It is bipartisan. It is run by the Democrats and the Republicans. They're the ones who... The first presidential debates were run by the League of Women Voters. The very first, Kennedy and Nixon, was actually run by the networks. And that's why the first one was at the studios of WBBM in Chicago, and the other debates were when there was an ABC debate and an NBC debate. And then the League of Women Voters took them over when they finally came back in 16 years later, as you say, with Ford and Carter. And that went by the boards for all kinds of reasons that I decided not to examine in detail for my book, because it wasn't part of my purview or venue or interest, frankly. But there were some internal problems over the selection of the moderator and the panelists and all of that. And finally, the two parties got together and said, let's take it over. And that's what happened. And now they have the debate commission has co-chairs, one of the Democratic Party, one of the Republican Party. Mike McCurry is the Democratic co-chairman. He just replaced Paul Kirk, who was a temporary senator after Ted Kennedy died. And Frank Fahrenkopf, who's been the chairman from the very beginning, still the Republican. Both of them, McCurry, of course, worked for Clinton. Kirk and Fahrenkopf were both former chairs of their respective parties. The members of the commission, I don't know how many members there are, but they are evenly split among Wawa Democrats and Wawa Republicans. And they raise the money and they do the stuff. And there's an executive director, Janet Brown, who really runs it. And much of the independence of the debate commission is her responsibility. She's done it and pushed it.
Does the commission have a view, or is it trying to answer the question, is there an ideal format that we should establish once and for all?
No, they don't have a view. They always offer one. They do offer one. And the closest one was the one in 2008. And usually, then in negotiations with the debate commission, with the candidates, the ideal view is modified after negotiation.
So every time it's a negotiation, exactly.
Every time. They have, but increasingly, less is negotiated because the debate commission just announces where they're going to be, just announces who the moderators are going to be, and doesn't consult with the candidates. And they've gotten away with it. And then one step by step by step, they've become basically an independent operation.
But strictly speaking, the commission will now have the responsibility of selecting the moderators and setting the format.
That's right. Right, absolutely. Okay. Yeah, supposedly in negotiation, but it's a practical matter, the commission does it.
Well, Jim, this has been a fascinating discussion. Unfortunately, we are approaching that point in our program where we have time for just one last question. And that question is quite simply, why you? Why is it that, or how has it happened that of the 35 debates, you've moderated just about a third of them? You've moderated more than any other single person. What are the characteristics and properties that you have, if you can be self-critical for a moment and objective about this, that you think have made you such a favorite moderator so many times?
Well, the practical answer is they can't ever agree on anybody else.
I think you're being too modest.
I'll tell you a quick story. 1960, Clinton Dole. So that would have been 70, where the hell was that? No, that was 90, sorry. Never mind. It was 96.
Six.
The debate commission called me and asked me if I would moderate the first debate between Dole and Clinton, and I agreed. And then I went off to moderate a debate that we were having, PBS was having, called Debate Night. It was among the leaders of the Congress of the United States at Colonial Williamsburg. And I was getting ready, and I was in the hotel room with my wife, and the phone rings, and it's the executive producer of the NewsHour, Les Crystal, as an intermediary, saying, "Oh, Jim, hey, these representatives of the two candidates, Dole and Clinton, have been up for hours, and they're yelling and screaming at each other. They somebody wanted Oprah, somebody wanted somebody else, and whatever." And so finally they said to me, they called me and said that two main negotiators got on the phone with him, in other words, Les Crystal, the executive producer, and said, "Look, we just got to get this over with and go to bed and get this thing over with. We can agree on Larry. Do you think he would agree to do all the debates?" So Les asked the question, and I turned to my wife, Kate, and I said, "Well, what do you think?" And she said, "Why not?" So that's how it happened. And then I did all of them in 2000. The debate commission just arbitrarily called me and said, if you are asked to do all of them, would you do them?" And I said, "What?" This was right at the very beginning. And I said, "Okay, sure. Yeah, I'll do it." And, it was just like that. So it wasn't what they were trying to do. A lot of it has to do with things that didn't have anything to do with me. It had a little bit to do with me. I mean, I've been doing it. And I have all kinds of little things. You know, I have a rule, for instance, that when I'm moderating a debate, and here's Sammy Sue candidate over here and Billy Bob candidate over there, and I'm in the middle, and I ask Sammy, Billy Bob a question, I look at him while he's talking. I never look at the other one. I don't want to be part, I don't have eye contact with the other candidate and in any way influence the reaction shot in any way like that. I have a little private rule that some people disagree with. Some of my fellow and sister journalists think it's absurd, and I've been criticized for it, which is I don't think you should open up new subjects in a presidential debate. It should be about what's already been the campaign. And I also have ironclad rules against cheap shots. I mean, I could easily, all you got to do, somebody said, I said this to a group recently. I said, "Oh my God, I could easily, you know, embarrass anybody, any candidate without just like that." And they said, "What do you mean? How would you do that?" And I said, "Okay, how about this? Well, candidate Billy Bob, candidate Sammy Sue, both of you want to be president of the United States, and of course that's going to make you the commander-in-chief of the United States and responsible for all diplomatic things, and you're going to have to really have a good knowledge of the rest of the world. So let's just go through the rest of the world. Who is the prime minister of Uzbekistan?" And oh, by the way, Upper Volta, whatever happened to Upper Volta? Isn't it got another name now? When did that happen and why did that happen? I mean, you can embarrass these people so easily. And it's so, anyhow, they know I'm not going to do that. And I never have done it, and I'm not about to do it. And so that may be part of it, too.
Okay. Well, whatever by whatever path you got there, Jim, I think I speak for everybody in this room that the country has been fortunate to have you, and the whole political process has been enhanced by your role in it. So thank you very much.
Thank you, David. Thank you. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we'd like to thank Jim Lehrer, author of Tension City, Inside the Presidential Debates from Kennedy-Nixon to Obama-McCain, and David Kennedy, Donald J. McLaughlin Professor of History Emeritus at Stanford University, and our audience here in Palo Alto, and those of you joining us on the radio. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.